start again.
It was said that Dr. Shah owned half of the babies and half of the people in Warren or in the valley here because the people never paid him for delivering the children. And when he did get paid, sometimes we're talking about the same depression now that we've been talking about, that people didn't have any money to speak of. And he might get a bushel of carrots or a quarter of a beef or a half a pig or something if people owed him quite a bill, and he took his pay that way. And it seems, I can't tell you in a few words what Dr. Shah was like, but he was one of the old school. And they said that he knew more about medicine than most any of these other doctors, that he'd had all this good training. And I remember going to his office, and he had these shelves along the wall, and there were gallon jugs after gallon jugs, glass jugs of pills sitting up there. Now, I always wondered what he did with so many pills, but before he would give anyone a pill, he would always put it in his mouth and chew it up and taste of it. I don't know what that had to do with it. But anyway, there was this young lady, it seems, in Facetown, and this was when I was in my last year, I believe, in high school. And some of the boys from high school had gone up there and seen her, at least four of them. And they discovered afterwards that they had gonorrhea. And, of course, the first thing they did was go to Dr. Shah. And so about three or four of them had already been in this very pompous man that was, you'd think to see him strut around that he owned the whole valley, you know, but he didn't. That was his way of carrying on. And he was a smart enough fellow and a very good musician and all that. But he went up to Dr. Shah one morning and he said, Dr. Shah, I have a friend that thinks he might have caught gonorrhea, and he wondered if I would stop in to your office and get some medicine for him. And Dr. Shah pulled his glasses down on his nose and looked over his glasses at this young fellow, and he says, boy, you better take that friend out and let me have a look at it. Of course, my father was the type of man who would never believe in going to a dentist, and he had all these troubles with his teeth, and he was having boils and carbuncles and whatnot come out, and they told him that those teeth should come out. Dr. Shah told him. He never went to a, I don't think he ever sat in a dentist chair in his life. I'm pretty sure he didn't. Anyway, it was decided that he would, I believe it was 14 teeth that he had left, and he was going to have them out. And Dr. Shah came to our house and sat my father down in a chair in the living room and got out his pliers and would hitch right onto one of those teeth and then another, and my father never had, he didn't give my father a thing. Every time one of those teeth would part company with him, you'd hear him grunt a little, but he stood it, and...
Oh, I mean, what coward I am.
Yeah.
They ask me if I want Novocaine, I get it.
Oh, yeah, me too. I always insist on Novocaine for anything that they do for me, but see, I tell you, and I spend a lot of time trying to make people understand that the old people were tough. They were tough, and they had a mind of their own, and you didn't need to try to change it because you weren't going to. In other words, if my father had made up his mind that Dr. Shah was going to pull those teeth, it wouldn't have amounted to a thing to told him about the best dentist in the world, that he could go to a dentist and not be hurt. He wouldn't go. he would do it that way. And that's the way they were.
Yeah, I think we've lost that toughness. Or most of us have. Mm-hmm. My generation.
I want to elaborate a little bit more about how strange these people were in way back in those days, about they had a mind of their own and they got something in their mind and that was the way it should be and that was the way it was going to be. And I remember hearing about Elwin Shirley, and he owned this little bit of a farm just below Upper Granville on the right as you're going down, and he had wintered a bunch of heifers, and he had started up towards Patterson Brook, up towards Rob Ford's farm. He had a pasture, it seems, that bordered on Rob Ford's pasture up there, where he kept his young cattle. And Elwin Shirley was taking those heifers up there, and he met Rob Ford coming down the hill with his horse and buggy. And Rob says, what are you doing with that bull in with those heifers, Elwin? And Elwin says, well, the heifers are at an age where they need to be bred this summer. And he says, it's going to make quite a lot of difference. If I don't get them bred, they aren't going to be saleable. And Rob says, I'm going to turn out some heifers right in the pasture next to yours, and I don't want mine bred. And he said, that bull is going to be getting over the fence and in with my heifers. And he says, I don't want you to take him up there, Elwin. Well, Elwin says, I'm going to take him. It's my pasture and my animal, and I'm going to take him. And so he took him. But when Elwin got his heifers down that fall, this animal was with him, of course, too. And he found that none of his heifers had been bred, because Rob Ford took his two boys and went over in the pasture and caught that bull and cut him. So he was a steer instead of a bull. And Rob had made up his mind he wasn't going to have a bull there, and there wasn't a bull there.
What I wanted to ask you was, and I think you alluded to it, was that actually the Mad River and the White River rise not too far from where Rob Ford lived. Is that, well, I guess.
Up in that woods, yes. But the falls, you know where the falls are in Granville Woods?
Moss Glen Falls.
Don't come from Rob Ford's farm. They come from Patterson Brookway.
Oh, they do.
To the right. Now, there's a brook it's Patterson Brook that you cross just after you turn to the right. And that brook there goes back on Rob Ford's property. So that brook comes down down in Granville, yes, that feeds White River. That comes into White River.
And then there is another brook that feeds the Mad River that's not too far from there, right?
When you're going towards Granville, you go over the top of a rise in the road, and it's very distinguishable because you have been coming along this flat where the swamps are.
Mm-hmm.
And after you get by the last swamp, it raises just a little bit there and then starts down again.
Going toward Granville.
Yes.
Yes, I know just where you mean.
And that place right there is where White River and Mad River start. Anything this side that comes this side of the top of that little hill comes to Mad River, and anything on the south side of it goes to White River.
So if I walked back in there from the road, I would find the two brooks, the rise of them? Or is it back up?
Mad River mostly starts from those little ponds that you see.
I was wondering that, because I've often looked at the water, as you know, and it's flowing, obviously, toward Granville, and then pretty soon, after you get through that flat place, you notice that it's flowing the other way.
If any brooks that you see north of there coming down is going into Mad River. The others are going into White River. I remember working for John Eaton when I was a young man, and I had a truck, and I was putting lumber on the cars at Bethel for John Eaton, and I had two men helping me, Jack Laro and Richard Markham. Richard Markham. And it seems that Fremont Lovett had lost three heifers from his farm up in East Warren, and he couldn't find them anywhere. And one morning, we drove from Warren to Granville, Hancock, each day with the truck, and then came back that night with it. And on our way out this particular morning, here were these three Guernsey heifers standing in the middle of the road. And Richard, I believe Jack was driving, and Richard was in the middle, and I was on the right-hand side. And Richard said to me, "Change places with me quick." And so I changed places with him so that he could be out there. And he said to Jack, drive right up beside of one of those heifers. And he... So Jack did, and by the time we got real close to the heifers, they had started running right down the road, you know, away from us. And Richard stepped out on the running board to the truck, and he said, "Jack, drive as close as you can to her." And Jack drove right up beside that heifer, and Richard left the truck and went right onto that heifer's back. And she... Of course, when that heft come on her, she went right down over the bank into that pond. And Richard, here this heifer and Richard Markham were scrambling together down in that goddamn pond, you know. And of course, he was soaking wet. And he hollered for us to bring a chain. And we didn't have any ropes, but we got a chain down there. And Jack and I both got wet getting a chain on her. But that heifer got chained to a tree. I'll never forget that.
That is funny. You never know what you're going to see going through there.
And I love that woods. I love that. I love East Warren, and it seems like I'm at home every time I go back there. And these are the people that I tell the jokes about when we have shows, and I must have 100 jokes about 100 different people. Oh, I would like to... did I tell you about my father having the sow that wouldn't own her pigs? And he had this neighbor, Amos Whistle, that lived over on what we call the Whalen Place, about a half a mile from my folks. And my father had this sow, and he had bred her and raised a litter of pigs, but she killed the pigs just as fast as they came. And sometimes they would do that. And Amos told my father that he could make that sow, says, "Go ahead and breed her again, raise another litter." Says, "I can make her own her pigs." And so my father bred her again, and here come the day that she was going to have the pigs, and he called, went over and told Amos he wanted him to come, and Amos got over there, and Amos said to my father, "Do you have any cider left?" And my father said, "I don't think there's much cider, but we'll go down and see." And he took this dishpan and went down cellar, and lo and behold, there was no cider that would run out of the spigot. But they took the spigot right out of the barrel, and here came this mother. They called it mother. It was strings of something that how do you describe that, Marion?
Jelly-like.
Jelly-like things that came in strings, and it would come so thick that it would plug the place, and they would grab a hold of that with a thumb and finger and pull that piece out, and then a little bit more cider would come, and then some more mother would come, and they got that dish pan half full or so of that kind of stuff. And about then, my mother said that it was time for dinner, and Amos said, well, go ahead and eat dinner, Alma, and I'll go down with the cell. And so he went down with the cell, and my father hurried up his dinner and went down afterwards. And here laid Amos right beside the old cell, dead drunk. He had eaten that stuff and gotten drunk, and he laid down there by the cell, and he had his arm over the cell, and he said, was talking sort of like anybody would in their sleep, and he said, Martha, I never realized that you had so many buttons on your nightdress. Talked about Mr. Palmer. It brought to mind about the Rich family who lived right there by my people at Blueberry Lake. And they had a large family. I believe there were seven of those children. And my parents, they said, had six at that time. So they made 13 children. Well, anyway, Mr. Rich became, what do I call it, sick in the head? No. Anyway, he had to take him to Waterbury.
Something like Alzheimer's? Or?
No, it wasn't Alzheimer's. It was just a...
Fits?
Sick. Just, he was sick and he had to go. He didn't know what he was doing and so on. And left that family there. And there was no help. Of course, the town would take hold and help anybody at that time if you called on them, but they didn't. They decided not to call on them, and my father and mother took that family into their home and fed them all summer, and Rich got out of Waterbury, I believe, in the fall and came back. But shortly after that, he hung himself up on Route 100. There was an old house up there near the line, and they found him hung up there. And there was, like I said, there were seven children in that family. And after that all happened, and the mother and the children moved down to Warren Village, right near where my sister Thelma lives now, to the north of there. And they had this disease.
Diphtheria?
I believe it was diphtheria that hit that family. And one boy, one of the sons, and two daughters died within days. Of just 2-3 days apart, and think what a terrible thing that must have been. There were.
Yeah, the hardships were hard.
Yeah. Hardships were hard, and they didn't know how to doctor these diseases at that time, and a great many times the people were too stubborn to go to the doctor, and they thought up some remedy of their own, and perhaps it had worked at times, but I think we're better off now. Of course, we're better off with the doctors that we have and the hospitals. When Amos E. Fuller was select man, and he drove into my father's yard with the snow roller, rolling the roads, I remember that his harnesses were wired together in places with wire and hitched together with baler twine and things like that. And I looked out and I thought to myself that it was a lot different than my father's team. And just to think that that place now is that Amos E. Fuller farm is being sold for well over $500,000. And people back in those days were having a hard time to get. My father and mother paid $1,000 for that farm at Blueberry Lake when they bought it. And of course, they had made some improvements and so on, but it sold for $315,000.
Who owns your farm now?
A man by the name of Mr. Keir. Keir, K-E-I-R.
Jack
Keir owns that, and he had the pond built. Leonard Robinson built the pond there.
Is it just before Blueberry Lake, your farm?
No, it's right there.
Oh, where
Blueberry.
Is it?
Yeah, that's it right there.
That was the swamp.
Oh. Hmm. And how many acres was it?
I can't tell how many acres. It's around 300 acres.
Mm-hmm.
But they had, afterwards, they found out that there weren't as many as they thought there were because, something about the deeds got fouled up way back there and they didn't. I've heard some of the people say that ran the lines in the woods, that some of these old deeds said, the corner of such a property was up where Dolly had her colt, and things like that. And it's so they weren't very particular because the land was at $1 an acre or something like that after it had been logged off. I went up in the pasture, you know, and he said. And he came back to tell his father that he said, I knew just the minute I saw the colt that the old mare had foaled. And another fellow, a kid that went to the barn and came back all out of breath to tell his father that old Bryn has got a calf. Twins, by God. And they look so much apart you can't tell them alike. Now that's getting some excited.
Well, I was told also about, I guess I was going to ask, I'm going to ask Everett Palmer this. I think it was Rupert Blair told me about Dwight Palmer, who was milking and the cow stepped in the bucket of milk. And you know the story?
No.
Oh, so he picked up the bucket and gave it to the cow to drink.
I heard something like that about the boy that was milking the cow by hand and she peed in the bucket and he ran as fast as he could and dumped it in the strainer. And he said, his father asked him what in the dickens he was doing that for. Well, he said, it'll strain the impurities right out. He said,
this one might run better.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.